then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's March the 15th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, I can tell already that I'm running way long this week. It's those panel discussions. Some of them are so good and so fascinating because I can never remember from one week to another what we've said that I end up cutting out too big a chunk of them, and that takes up too much time, and so I run out of time for my own rants and raves. And I'm also a bit rushed again this week. So I really don't have time to sit and type out a script, and I'm going to have to ad-lib this one, and so excuse me if this is a little bit rough, but I have been promising you folks for some weeks now that I was going to discuss a movement phenomenon which I think all of us who have had any experience are familiar with, and that is the phenomenon of what I call the T-shirt youth. These are young, single, white men, ranging in age from about 19 on up to 40 or so, although I know 40 isn't a youth, but I think you get the idea. And these single men, many of whom are kind of dysfunctional in various ways, have just kind of never been able to fit into American life. And the result is that they're in their 20s, maybe even early 30s, or their teens, whatever, and they're wandering around the countryside with nothing but the T-shirts on their backs. In some cases, they had jobs and have been laid off. In other cases, they've just never been able to settle down to a particular job. In many cases, basically, they dicked off in school, and so they never bothered to acquire any actual marketable skills, which is another reason they have problems with gainful employment. Or, in some cases, of course, them and gainful employment tend to march to the beat of a different drummer, so to speak. And I get all this. Believe me, there is nothing worse for a young man of spirit and soul and creativity than to have to get up every morning, hear that damned alarm go off at 5:30 in the morning, whenever you got to get up in order to get to some stupid place that you don't want to go, and do stupid things that you don't want to do with stupid people that you detest, and worse yet, have these same stupid people in complete power over you for 8 to 10 hours per day. That's not cool. I know, because I remember from my own youth how atrocious that whole life experience is. Now, I was always able to settle down for fairly long periods of time into the world of work for temp agencies and various other low-paid menial jobs because I knew and understood that I had to do it. Getting up every morning when that damned alarm went off at 5:30, dressing up in stiff, scratchy clothes that I didn't really want to wear, wrapping a piece of cloth around my neck, driving in sometimes through the darkness in winter through horrible traffic to go to some place and sit in a cubicle or work in a warehouse where I didn't really want to be with stupid people bossing me around. Yeah, I hated it. But I knew that it had to be done, because otherwise I'd end up living under a bridge. I had and still have rent to pay at the end of every month. and I understood that I would do no one any good, either myself or the 14 words, if I ended up living under a bridge. And so for that reason, I was always willing and able to compromise. I had to learn to accept the world as it is. Now, it's true that some jobs were just too much, and on more than one occasion over the past 30 years or so, I've literally flipped the boss the finger and walked out the door and said, you know, literally, take this job and shove it. I get that, but I was always able to reach enough of an accommodation with the capitalist system, you might say, to where I was able to survive. Many of the t-shirt youth that I refer to have not been able to do that. The result is that they're job hoppers, they move from job to job, they seem unable to hold a job for more than a few weeks, a few months at a time. And so that's the first distinguishing mark of the t-shirt youth. Another distinguishing feature of them is a general dysfunctionality in society, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. Basically, American society, politically correct society, produces a lot of damaged young white men, and of course young women as well, lest we forget. And it's interesting that we're starting to see this phenomenon in girls as well as boys, but for many years, American society, politically correct society, has produced large numbers of these damaged young white men who not only don't fit in into the politically correct world, who not only don't want to fit in, but who basically have been so badly damaged they can't fit in various ways. Sometimes, in a moment of youthful idiocy, they covered their bodies with tattoos that they now do not have the money to get rid of. Sometimes they committed stupid criminal acts that are on their record now forever. Sometimes they basically just did dumb things that are going to stay with them for the rest of their lives. Sometimes it's a matter of attitude. Sometimes it's a matter of a complete inability to adjust to an unnatural world. Now, I get all these things. Let me make it clear here. I'm not criticizing these kids. And by the way, there's hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of them out there. Only a small fraction of them ever get attracted to the movement, to the Aryan Nations, to the NSM, to us, whatever, because only a small fraction of them ever even find out that we exist. But when they do, of course, they have certain problems. A lot of these young single men are attracted to groups like ours because of the stereotypes, not in spite of them. A lot of these young men believe when they come in, they're going to be put in charge of a concentration camp or something like that. I have to deal almost every week with the phenomenon of young guys who read my novels, and it's like they don't realize it's fiction. They seriously think that this is what's going on up in the Northwest right now, and they think they're going to come up here and be handed a rifle and a hand grenade and go told to kill somebody for the NVA. I think most of you probably realize who I'm talking about, because most of us have run into some of these t-shirt youth over the past few years. And, of course, now that we have the Obama depression, there's more and more of them, and it's no longer a matter of choice or inability to adjust or mental or emotional dysfunction, nothing like that. The system itself is now producing millions of these t-shirt youth through the simple inability to give these young kids any jobs at all. Now, back when I was doing my temp agency thing all those years, the economy got pretty bad at various points. But if you looked hard enough, if you hustled, there was always some kind of job out there that you could get, and you could bring in just enough money to pay the rent and keep you out from under that bridge. Hell, if nothing else, you could always go to work for Pinkerton. But now, with the Obama depression, there's millions of these t-shirt youth out there who can't get or hold a job because there simply aren't any jobs to get. Now, in the movement sense, these t-shirt youth, those that know we exist, have always had a certain tendency to gravitate towards our kind of group. That's only natural. Any revolutionary group appeals mostly to the people who have been disenfranchised by the existing system. And in our case, that's mostly white males, especially young white males. And so it's only natural that the majority of the people who are attracted to groups like ours should be young white males. Anytime any group such as ours has been able to offer these kids something by way of a bunkhouse, a place to flop, a half-assed, quote-unquote, job where they get paid $20 a week, pocket money or something of that kind, for strolling around the property, waving a gun in the air and pretending to be a security guard, that kind of stuff. Hell, I just described Aryan Nations. Anytime any group has been able to offer that to the t-shirt youth, all of a sudden they turn around and they've got more guys than they can handle. If we were offering that in the Northwest right now, we would have more volunteer immigrants than we could handle. If we could offer the t-shirt youth a place to flop and a little make-work job and give them maybe $50 a week, pocket money, something like that, we would be overrun. Unfortunately, things aren't like that. We don't have any compounds up here. Now, we are working on that. We are trying to beef up our presentation, so to speak. I won't get into that here. That's being dealt with internally in the organizational letters and elsewhere. But over the coming year, we are going to try to make some improvements so we can at least show some people something more than we're showing them. I understand the necessity for that. It will be a very, very long time, if ever, before we are in a position to offer the t-shirt youth the free flop and the can of beans and the refrigerator full of beer that seems to be necessary to obtain their services. This is one problem we're having attracting new migrants. We're not in a position to give them things. New migrants have to understand that they are going to have to come here on their own bat, just like the pioneers did. There was no one waiting for the pioneers, the first white people who came to the West 150 years ago in those covered wagons. They simply piled everything they owned into the wagon and they started walking westward. In a sense, that's what we're demanding as well. We have to because we just don't have the resources and the money to give people things. We can provide a certain limited amount of help during your transition, but that's it. Now, the t-shirt youth want to come here. They read my books. They're excited by the idea of a revolution in the Northwest. Many of them have kind of lived on a long diet of racial, nationalist, and other white material, and so they get it. Every week, I get emails from people that I can just tell by the email they're t-shirt youth. Young men with nothing but the t-shirts on their back. And basically what they're saying is, yeah, Harold, let's do it. Come on, I want to come Northwest. Can you give me some help? You know, can you send me a bus ticket or plane ticket? Or can you send me some money to fix up my car? Or can you send somebody to pick me up? And when I get there, can you give me a bunk to flop on or something like that? Because these are guys that have got $10 in their pockets. They want the party to come and whisk them away on a magic carpet to the Northwest. Well, we would if we could. Someday we're going to be in a position to do that. I still envision this system where in years to come, every spring we'll be sending out trucks, moving vans, going to these niggerized neighborhoods in the cities where there's one white family left on some street full of niggers and Mexicans and physically loading up these people's furniture and whatever they have and putting these people in the truck and bringing them home, getting them the hell out of there. I honestly believe that one day we'll be doing that. That day is not now. You guys and the t-shirt youth are going to have to understand, right now we can't give you anything. When you come here, you're going to have to come on your own bat. You're going to have to find your own job. You're going to have to find your own accommodation. That means that where you are, you're going to have to start making preparations. You're going to have to get and obtain a job somehow. I know that's hard in this economy, but you're going to have to do it. You're going to have to hold that job for probably at least a year while you save money. That means every Friday you get your temp agency slip signed by the little girl who's your supervisor and you get your paycheck and you save every penny of it you can. You don't go to the 7-Eleven and buy a 12-pack of beer. You don't go out to a club. You don't go out and play pool. You don't go out and rent video games. You actually save your money. You stay home and read books. Don't watch TV. You shouldn't have cable TV. It costs too much. You're going to have to plan. You're going to have to organize yourself, and you're going to have to save money, and then you're going to have to come here on your own bat and make it on your own. There are those who say we need to be doing this out of general Darwinian principles. They may have a point. It could be that a lot of these t-shirt youth are basically just useless kids who are too badly damaged to be of any good anyway, and by giving them things, if we were able to give them a bunkhouse and a can of beans and a refrigerator full of beer, we wouldn't be doing ourselves or them any favors. That may well be. But this is making a virtue out of a necessity. So all you guys out there with nothing but the t-shirts on your back, I sympathize. Contact me. I will help you get ready spiritually and materially. We in the Northwest Front will give you any help you need except for actual money and physical assistance because we don't have it to give. I know this whole thing may be a bit of a downer. I don't mean to get you guys depressed. I don't mean to demoralize you. I don't mean to run you down. But I'm just telling you like it is. We want you to come here. We want to give you a purpose in life. We want to give you a new homeland. We want to give you a new life, but you're going to have to help yourself. You're going to have to show the discipline and the self-control and the application and the dedication necessary to take this new life for yourself, because materially speaking, we're just not in a position to help you. As you know, I have a couple of more or less holiday traditions for Radio Free Northwest, including playing spooky music for Halloween and Christmas music on the closest show to December 25th. I'm going to start another such tradition since it's now just 2 days away from St. Patrick's Day, or Lallefodrick as it's actually referred to in Ireland. I know, I play so much Irish music on here already that some of you might think it's St. Patrick's Day every week. I'm sure some of you folks feel that way about my constant Irish musical selections, but what can I tell you? I lived there on and off for 5 years when I was on the run from the Greensboro Grand Jury, and my children were born there. Plus, Ireland is the land where I saw how these things are really done in the real world. Now, I'm not going to go off into a long ramble about Ireland or the Irish situation, but what I will do is play a few special Irish selections tonight to try and give you guys a little flavor of the place besides St. Paddy's Night and Green Beer and crap. One of the most famous types of Irish music is the rebel song, and I've played quite a few samples of that on here, but this is probably the greatest rebel song of them all, or maybe I just feel that way because I've heard Tommy Makem sing this one live in the Gaiety Theatre. I swear, if this one doesn't put a mask on some kid's face and a gun in his hand and send him out into the rain to murder the First Presbyterian he comes across, I don't know what will. This is Tommy Makem.
Say, I have four green fields.
bondage in strangers' hands who try to take it from me. But my son's absence, as brave as were their fathers, my fourth green field will bloom once again, said she.
Hi guys, this is Axis Sally, and it looks like I won't be voting in the next presidential election after all, now that my favorite National Socialist candidate Brian Holland has outed himself as an informant. Recently, I had to get fingerprinted for work, and I got this official-looking letter saying I needed to explain some of the things found in my FBI file. I had to request a copy of the file first, and I figured I knew what this was about. So I got the file, and it read, "This person has no criminal convictions or pending charges. Just a file for no apparent reason, except maybe Brian, who probably gave out some information about me as part of his job." Not only did Brian inform on the NSM, he was also paid to spy on some drug dealers and PETA. I can just imagine him taking off his Nazi uniform to go buy crack and then stripping down and locking himself in a cage outside a zoo. He seems like the kind of guy who might forget which assignment he was on for that day. I'm sure there was many a time when he showed up to one of his vegan freak meetings with his swastika armband on and a whole lot of explaining to do. This is hilarious to me. I remember Brian from back when I was in the NSM, and the thought of this boring slob actually running for president was amusing. He claims to have been paid $8,000 per month to inform on these various groups. Clearly, I am in the wrong business. I mean, I only get about $7,000 per month to send out autographed Radio Free Northwest transcripts. Too bad I have a background that makes people cry and throw up, otherwise I could make a good living like Brian. I wonder what it is about PETA that was worth so much money to the FBI. Why would anyone care about self-righteous, ugly people who get off on telling the world they don't wear fur? I was planning on writing about how much I hate vegetarians anyway, and I didn't know I'd be helped along by this Brian fellow. So, anyway, we all have pictures in our minds of what the men and women of the NVA look like. Some people have sent us very impressive drawings. What is most depicted in the artwork is physical strength. I don't know about you, but when I try to envision Cat Eyes Lockhart or Zach Hatfield, I generally imagine someone who weighs more than 130 pounds. Vegetarians are feeble-minded losers who put the feelings of cute little animals above their own physical health and bodily needs. You can usually spot them. There are some racialist groups who recommend their great warriors follow weird low-calorie and low-protein diets. They encourage the protectors and providers of their race to look like walking skeletons with sunken eyes. Is it any wonder why we have so many young white men who are medically diagnosed with low testosterone and other forms of wimpiness? You need fat in your diet and on your body to make hormones. You need to eat some saturated fat and cholesterol, or certain things just don't work anymore. You know who you are, and hopefully you're ashamed every time you look in the mirror. Now, I know someone out there who probably looks like an anorexic sack of AIDS is rubbing his bony hands together in anticipation of getting to comment that Hitler was a vegetarian. And therefore, if I ever have a disparaging word against anything the Führer said, thought, or did, I have 6 million things wrong with me. Well, it's never been a requirement that to be a white nationalist or to support the Northwest Front or join the NVA, you have to agree with Adolf Hitler on every single point. But I decided to do some reading, since this is kind of my main subject of interest. I mean, Nazis and food, there just aren't enough hours in the day. I wanted to know just how much of a vegetarian he really was. Was he one of those freaks who wouldn't even eat honey because to do so would bully bees? Or was he more of a sub-fish and chicken for beef kind of guy? And of course, different people said different things, the same way they did with his alleged drinking or not drinking. Some sources say he did not drink at all. Some say only beer. Some say beer and wine. Same thing with the meat. Some say he enjoyed foods such as sausages, stuffed pigeon, or trout, while others say he ate sausage only on occasion, and still others claim he shunned all animal products, even cosmetics for women, because they were made from animal ingredients. I imagine we'll never know because we weren't there, and because so much of what is published about Hitler and the Third Reich is, well, you know. But what one person did or did not do several decades ago should not matter when it comes to what is lacking in white males today. Courage, strength, and general manliness. It's really sad when I meet a white man who has hands that look like they came out of an Oil of Olay commercial. Not one callus or scar to show that at one point in his life he lifted a heavy object or struggled to support his family. Where are the men with the dog bites, the bullet holes, the surgically reattached ears? The men who have never heard of tofu and pedicures and talking about their feelings? Remember the comrade who asked me to call all the men together to fight? I'd love to, but I'm hoping to draw from the pool of men who are not afraid to kill a cute little deer. Once you start talking about animal rights, you may as well have just said women's rights for how much you deserve to be heard. So, Brian, if that is your real name, I'm sorry the FBI fired you and now you have to go out and get a real job. Judging by your appearance, you haven't really done much in the way of manual labor, so maybe the daring exposé you plan to write will pay off. Thanks for telling the feds that I was an entire 5'2" tall and had green eyes. You were quite generous there. If you ever want to chat, you know, one NSM member to another, I'd love to hear what goes on at those PETA meetings. And everyone else, go eat a steak.
Okay, Gretchen the Librarian is up now, and she's reviewing a biography of the Italian proto-fascist Julius Evola. Before she begins, I just want to interject a quick personal note here. Now, I first ran across Evola in the 1970s, and he does have a small number of American votaries of his cult, if you want to call it that. I've actually read some of Evola's stuff many years ago, and he's not bad. A little light on race and way light on the Jewish question, but then Italian fascism always was. Our intellectuals have a habit of trying to replace solid racial theory and conviction with airy-fairy spiritual stuff and speaking in code words so they don't have to offend anybody and they don't risk getting into trouble and having bad men knock on their doors. And I've noticed that Evolaites are very much like that. Back in the day, they tended to publish little 4- or 8-page newsletters printed in very small 10-point type that had a subscription list of a couple of hundred people at most. Evolaism is a very narrow field, dare I say incestuous. Of course, they took to the internet like a duck to water, and now you've got all kinds of Evolaites all over cyberspace. I learned long ago, when I was dealing with a new contact, that the first time I hear the name Julius Evola in a conversation, or see it on a blog, that's it. I've got that guy pretty accurately pigeonholed. I'm dealing with a pseudo-intellectual, or possibly even a real intellectual, and we do have a few, you know. But in any case, I'm dealing with an individual who is never, ever going to actually do anything at all, not even contribute money. So for this reason, anytime I come across the name of Evola, I generally move on, because it's pretty much certain there's nothing there for the Northwest Republic. Now, all of that having been said, however wimpy his individual devotees may be, Evola is in fact a legitimate part of our history and our philosophical heritage. He will be studied in school in the Northwest Republic, and he does have a place in our worldview. So, here's Gretchen.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'd like to talk to you about Julius Evola. This is an Italian intellectual who is operating in the years of the teens and even into the early 1970s. And he writes an intellectual autobiography called The Path of Cinnabar, which means the path of Mercury, the path of the messenger of the gods. So he has a healthy self-esteem. And his whole project in life is the reconciliation of opposites. He starts out his career as an artist who is involved in the Dadaist movement. And the Dada movement in art was something that came about during the teens. And it came about, really, in my opinion, as a protest against World War I. And it was really an anti-art movement. It was sort of the art of the absurd. Because he was, at this time, rather depressed, he became involved in this particular art movement. I think as a way of saying that Western society was sort of in crisis, and the only response was to turn to the art of the absurd. But he soon tires of this movement, and he decides that he's really interested in activities such as writing. So he starts getting involved in certain things, such as an idea that he calls magical idealism, where he's trying to reconcile the egotistical self to the self that is sort of involved in the world as it's presented. So he's trying to figure out how somebody could become impenetrable to things like criticism. And he feels that if you operate entirely within your society without sort of self-analysis or ego, that you can become impenetrable to criticism or attack. And this is an idea that he relates to Eastern philosophy and becoming one with Brahman, becoming somebody that doesn't have an individual will anymore. He's always trying to attack this problem from different angles, and he starts to study Eastern philosophy. He becomes very interested in Tantra, which is an Eastern philosophy where you're always trying to go beyond dualities and go beyond convention. So he becomes very involved in that. He sees that as a way to sort of, as he says, he talks about riding the tiger, and he always forms these various different groups. He gets involved in something called the Ur group, which gets into some trouble because he's always very outspoken and his friends are very outspoken. And some of his friends start making comments that seem rather critical of Mussolini, and so for a time his writing is banned. Then he starts publishing another magazine that he calls La Tour. And he states in this, he begins to state that because he is a traditionalist and he believes in initiation and hierarchy, he believes that fascism is really the best political ideology at the time because it has the best chance of restoring a sort of hierarchy and a Roman ethos he wishes could be restored. But he still criticizes it because he's concerned it's not intellectual enough. So then he gets involved with different magazines, he gets his own editorial page, and he starts to write about Catholicism. He has some critiques of that, but again, he likes the monastic tradition and he likes the discipline that can be a part of certain Catholic traditions, but he's really not keen on the entire tradition. He starts writing this other book. He writes a book called Revolt Against the Modern World because he doesn't like the egalitarian ideas, things like Marxism. He thinks they're very degenerate. He doesn't like democracy very much. He's well received in Germany. He also tends to endorse the National Socialist ideology as well. Now, of course, National Socialism and fascism are not quite the same thing because National Socialism certainly has a racial component, whereas fascism doesn't necessarily. However, fascist Italy was influenced by Germany and they started developing certain racial ideologies as well. because of that influence from Germany. Now, Evola does talk about the issue of race, and he is concerned with the issue of physical race, but he's also concerned with the race of the spirit and of the character. So he has a more non-materialistic definition of race that he emphasizes more than other writers will emphasize. I think to a certain extent this is true for everybody, but he may emphasize the dematerial aspects more than other writers. Ultimately, when it comes to the end of the war, he writes a book called Men Among Ruins, and he tends to advise people in the modern age that really they should develop a inner resistance to modernity, but that they really should not act against modernity. Instead, they should just behave in a way that seems outwardly conformist. So it's as if he's recommending a life of quiet desperation that Henry David Thoreau talks about, and saying that's sort of the best you can do. He's interviewed in the early 70s, and he says that if there was a group, he would get involved in it, but because there were no groups at the time that were advocating his ideas, he says that he'd rather just write and not specifically get involved with anyone. So this book just gives an overview of all his projects. I think to understand him better, I would definitely have to read each of his books, because his ideas are complex, but they really all seem to be this idea of reconciling the dualities between wanting to transcend and wanting to be intellectual, and then also still wanting to act in the world, and to what degree action in the world is appropriate or can be done. And I decided to read this book because I was reading another article in my Occidental Quarterly, and I was reading this very significant article called Libertarianism versus Racial Nationalism, Implications for the Environment by George Hocking. I think that's an incredibly important article because what it says is it talks about the idea of the exidial age and the non-exidial age. This writer is saying that there was an age very early on where the spirit was not considered to be separate from the material. But later on, what happened as people became more, I guess, technically advanced and developed more ideas about the world, and people started to see the spirit as separate from the material, and then that became the exidial age. This author is really saying that the best thing that we could do is go back to the non-exidial view of the world. The author says that a lot of people think that the key to being a really good white nationalist is to be somebody who has a lot of conservative viewpoints. And the reason for that is because during the French Revolution, there were the liberals who were always trying to make social reform, and I guess the conservatives that tended to be opposed to the liberals making all these reforms. But really, both the liberals and the conservatives, even as far back as the French Revolution, were really exidial in their viewpoint. They had the spiritual and they had the material, and those things were separate. And so the author says that it's really not a matter of a particular political ideology like liberal or conservative. It's really a matter of white nationalism as being like any other biodiversity conservation project. So you could adopt any policy, you could adopt a liberal or a conservative policy based on your needs, but the project is transcendent of those dualities. And the author of this article was criticizing Evola as being too spiritual in his approach to race, and so I wanted to read about Evola to see if that was a justified criticism. And I don't think that criticism is entirely justified, but I do think that Evola was very concerned with dualities, and I think that the author of this article, this Hocking, is saying that one should forget entirely about dualities. So I thought that was a really interesting talk that I could give for you today. So I hope you enjoyed it. All right, thank you for listening.
I My song for you this evening, it's not to make you sad, nor for adding to the sorrows of our troubled northern land. But lately I've been thinking and it just won't leave my mind. I'll tell you of two friends one time who were both good friends of mine. Isaac Scott from Bena, he lived just across the fields. Great man for the music and the dancing and the reels. MacDonald came from South Armagh to poor Chung Agnes Fair. And we'd often meet on the Ryan Road and laughter filled the air. There were roses, roses. There were roses, and the tears of the people ran together. Now Isaac, he was Protestant and Sean was Catholic born, but it never made a difference, for the friendship it was strong. Sometimes in the evening when we heard the sound of drums, we said it won't divide us, we always will be one. For the ground our fathers plowed in, the soil it is the same, and the places where we say our prayers have just got different names. We talked about the friends who died, we hope there'd be no little, then we realized the tragedy in store. There were roses, roses, there were roses, and the tears of the people ran together. It was on a Sunday morning when the awful news came round. Another killing had been done just outside Camlet Town. We knew that Isaac danced up there, we knew he liked the band. But when we heard that he was dead, we just could not understand. We gathered at the graveside on a cold and rainy day. Minister, he closed his eyes, if no revenge he prayed. And all of us who knew him from along the Ryan Road bowed our heads and we said a prayer for the resting of his soul. There were roses, roses. Tears of the people ran together. Now fear had filled the countryside, there was fear in every home. Late at night a car came prowling round the Ryan Road. A Catholic would be killed tonight to even up the score. Oh Christ, it's young MacDonald that they've taken from the door. And Isaac was my friend, he cried, he begged them with his tears. The centuries of hatred of ears that cannot hear. An eye for an eye, it was all that filled their minds. And another eye for another eye to live. There were roses, roses, there were roses, and the tears of the people ran together. My song for you this evening, It's not to make you sad, nor for adding to the sorrows of our troubled northern land. But lately I've been thinking and it just won't leave my mind. I'll tell you of two friends one time who were both good friends of mine. Now I don't know where the moral is or where the song should end, but I wonder just how many wars are fought between good friends. And those who give the orders, they are not the ones to die. It's Scott and MacDonald and the likes of you and I. There were roses, roses, there were roses, and the tears of the people ran together. There were roses, roses, there were roses.
Well, are we into sharks and all?
I love sharks.
18-foot great white shark spotted off San Diego Beach.
A great white shark?
Can you put a racial spin on that?
We are the great white shark. I'm the great white shark. Everywhere I go, the sea parts for me.
Okay.
I am the pinnacle creation. I am the apex predator.
Okay. A great white shark was spotted off the coast of Imperial Beach, blah, blah. Guess what? They saw a shark. That seems to be the whole news story. They saw a very large shark. Okay.
Wow, there was like 10 sentences in that whole story.
Right, yeah.
I noticed a lot of news articles are getting shorter.
Oh,
shorter.
God.
She's a Jewess.
Mila Kunis. By the way, for those of you who can't see it, they got a picture here of the actress Mila Kunis. Real name is Milena. She's a Jew, born in Kiev. And again, that's a certain Jewish racial type there, one with a heavy Oriental mix. Okay. Iran to execute bloggers for spreading corruption.
Are they going to get you?
Well, I don't spread corruption in Iran. I can think of some bloggers that need to be executed over here for spreading corruption, but and they can't find it. Okay.
It's corrupted.
It's corrupted, yes. Bloggers have corrupted it.
Butt injection.
Fix a flat butt injection suspect attacked with syringe during talk show. Can't find it.
He was trying to flex his butt cheeks.
Okay.
He needs to be doing those squats. He needs to be doing those lunges.
Try that again. Oh, here we go. Okay, let's see if these are niggers. I'll probably have to edit this out. An attack with a fake syringe on a Spanish-language talk show Wednesday night was just the latest chapter in... Okay, I've seen one nigger. A bunch of niggers fighting over...
I don't think she needs butt injections.
It's kind of like some Miami nigger version of Jerry Springer.
Holy cow! Look at that ass, man. How many injections did she get?
You guys can't see this, so it isn't really fair, I think, for us to be talking about this. But basically, they had some talk show where a bunch of fat-ass negresses were yelling and screaming, and the white security guys were coming and dragging them off stage. An attack with a fake syringe on a Spanish-language talk show Wednesday night was just the latest chapter in the South Florida bad butt injection drama. Corey Eubank, that must have been the really fat-ass negress, was appearing on Telemundo's Christina show at the Blue Dolphin Studios in Doral when he was hit above his left eye by a prop syringe thrown by a woman. This is just silly. Eubank and 30-year-old O'Neill Ron Morris were arrested in November and charged with practicing medicine without a license after victims alleged Morris injected their legs and buttocks with a mixture that included Fix-A-Flat, cement, and superglue. So apparently these negresses wanted bigger legs and butts, and so this guy shot them up with Fix-A-Flat, cement, and superglue. Okay. According to police report, Eubank says the show was taped. She was attacked by Minetta Brown, the mother of Shaquanda Brown, one of Morris's and Eubank's alleged victims. Okay, video footage showed Eubank sitting in a chair before a member of the audience made her way onto the stage. Security guards, blah, 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 blah. Okay, here we go. More arrests for bad butt injections as second alleged victim comes forward. Okay, well.
Lewis said, the victim began referring to my client as a faggot.
That's bullying. Okay. It's odd that we were talking about black women not being able to find black males to date in the earlier article, because black males are notorious for liking black women with large gluteus maximi, shall we say. Hence the term booty call, booty, etc. in the Negroid lexicon. Anyway, Apparently, these guys were offering these nigger women in Miami bigger butts by injecting this goop, including rubber solution and cement and super glue, into their butts.
Nothing could possibly go wrong with that.
Yeah. And we really seriously consider these things to be equal and consider them to be running a technological society. Again, you guys, you're going to swear that I'm making this up. I was in Rhodesia. I heard this from people who were there at the time. I don't think they were lying. When Northern Rhodesia became the country of Zambia, the head nigger in charge was a coon named Kenneth Kaunda. And Kaunda wanted his country, Zambia, to be free of all of the vestiges of colonialism. And that includes the British custom of driving on the left. So he decided that, like the Americans and Europeans, Zambians would drive on the right. And then somebody in his cabinet suggested, well, Mr. President, will this not cause confusion among the people? And so Kaunda thought, says, yes, yes, I think I know what you mean. So he put out a law stating that the driving on the right would begin as of January the 1st, 1964. This was in the mid-60s. However, for a transition period for the first 3 months, only trucks and buses would drive on the right. I am not making this up. I don't know how it worked out, but we seriously believe that these people are equal. They're capable of voting. They're capable of sitting on juries. And that they can run a technological advanced society created by white people. They can't.
There's someplace in Africa, they have a civilian space agency, and they're trying to make a spaceship, and it's actually paper mache. I don't know what they're going to do on reentry, but they're making a paper mache rocket ship.
Well, Zambia had a space program for a while in the 70s. Every time there was a successful space launch at Cape Canaveral or Cape Kennedy, it was called then, they'd get a telegram congratulating the American NASA astronauts from their colleagues in the Zambian space program. And so finally some reporter wondered what was going on and went over and took a look at the Zambian space program. And they had a couple of their Air Force officers allegedly training for space. For acceleration, they would put them in oil drums and roll them down a hill. For weightless training, they'd put them on like a harness and swing them from trees. And he was talking to the minister for whatever it was. It was in charge of the space program. And I'm sure the reporter was desperately trying not to burst out laughing. But he said, well, Mr. Minister, what do you think the first achievement of the Zambian space program will be? And so the Kaffir was sitting there and says, well, you see, the Americans have already gone to the moon. And the Russians have put the space station in the orbit around the Earth, and so the first achievement of the Zambian space program is that Zambia will be the first nation to have an expedition to the sun. And
with their paper mache.
Their giant cement asses.
Well, they use that as ballast or something.
That's where all the black men have gone.
Well, the Zambian space program sent them all to the sun.
Hey, if they have that program, I'll send money. We need to figure out where I can do this. We can get more black men
to
go to the sun.
Will they take
Jews? Kaunda used to go on national TV in Zambia, and he would read the Zambian people the riot act, tell them just what horrible Kaffirs they were. He would actually break down and weep on TV because his people were so useless. The one that I saw, he was ranting and raving about the Zambian Barbers Union. The barbers in Zambian were overcharging. They were very sloppy. They were constantly trying to shave their customers drunk and cutting their throats. And he said, customers do not like this habit. I'm not kidding. It's like when the Belgians left the Congo, they left a completely modern state. 30 years later in Kinshasa, which used to be Leopoldville, there was grass growing in the streets and there were lions and zebras and wild animals roaming in the streets. The white man doesn't dare become extinct. We can't leave this country to these creatures.
If, leave this world.
For one thing, they wouldn't last. Let's face it, what would happen if the white man disappeared? The gooks would come in and simply kill them all. We've seen what they like to do in Cambodia when Pol Pot decided he wanted to alter his country's history by hammering out its future in blood. He simply shot everybody in spectacles because he thought they were intellectuals. So how do the niggers and even the Mexicans think that they're going to fare when the white man is finally gone and the Chinese move in?
Asians actually control three continents. They have Asia, and then they have North and South America, because the Amerindians are of Asiatic descent. Mm-hmm. So really, our biggest threat is not so much from Negroes. It's actually from Asians, and Kikes are of Asiatic derivative. Our biggest enemy, these Jews, are Asians.
I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm just going to leave the ladies in charge here, and I'm going to go talk so I don't inhibit them with my presence or whatever.
He's got to go do some guy stuff. I think the presence of three women here just kind of scared him off.
You know, I've heard somebody say that women are scarce in the movement, but I think that ultimately women with their mothering instincts will wake up and want to protect their children and will join us for that reason.
I hope so. I'd like to hear from a woman one day who maybe made the migration by herself and said, my husband refused to come with me and called me a horrible racist, and I came anyway. I mean, a lot of men do that. Their women won't let them be a racist, and they eventually cut her loose and decide that the cause is more important than an individual woman.
I wonder how many parents are proud of their children for wearing their pants down around their asses and look forward to having mulatto grandchildren.
Oh, yeah, that sounds great. Gee, I wish my kids would dress like that.
So their pants can fall down while they're going up the escalator and get caught in the escalator and pull their shirts down. That's fun.
I've seen so many hilarious instances of niggers doing everything they can to keep their baggy pants just belted above the knees and not hit the ground. They'll do anything but wear a belt. I've seen them trying to cross the street really quickly and doing that weird kind of duck waddling thing. I saw one, it was just so many stereotypes all in one that I had to leave. I couldn't handle it anymore. He was wearing the baggy pants and he was standing in line at KFC and he was kind of bebopping to some hip hop music on his Walkman. So anyway, I just wanted to know if the two of you could tell me a little bit about your experience as a female in the movement. Is it everything you thought it was going to be? Were you nervous about being one of just a few women?
I'm not nervous at all. But I wish there were more women. I wish there were more mothers I could talk to, and
I was a little bit nervous at first. I didn't know. I'd heard the Radio Free Northwest, and I knew that there weren't that many women in the movement, but I thought, I gotta do something, so it's different. It's unusual.
Well, more mothers is always a good thing to have. Any mother generally wants to have other mothers to talk to and share experiences with, on whether they're racially aware or not. And I think that's even more the case among our movement. We want to try to produce as many white children as we possibly can. And just, you know, sometimes, just from my experience, being a stay-at-home mother, it does get lonely sometimes. And there were times when I did wish I just had other women to spend time with.
One thing I have noticed, though, even though there aren't necessarily a lot of women to talk with, there are people to talk with who are racially aware. If you're here, but you can't do that if you're not here.
Okay, let's see what other madness we have here. Thing is, going down these news articles, we don't have to make these things up. Madonna fans beg Netanyahu hold off on strike on Iran until after the show. If the Jews really do attack Iran, it's quite possible that the world as we know it really could end, because all of a sudden gasoline will be up to about $12, $13 a gallon and we're going to lose one-third of the world's imported oil. But apparently the people in Israel don't care as long as Netanyahu doesn't go berserk until after Madonna has her concert. Well, huge-breasted model walks away from horror crash after her 38.
What? KKK?
Oh, let's look at that. It'll probably take it off. I can't think of a racial angle for this, but we can look at
her bra size is KKK.
Yeah. That's a racial angle.
Okay, right. Huge-breasted model 32 walks away from... I suppose there's a racial angle in this, and it shows what we consider to be important news these days.
Is she white or dark?
Shayla Hershey. Shayla. My woman, Shayla. That's looks like might be a Mexican or a Jew there. Look at the hair. Might be a highly yellow nigger.
Looks kind of like Kim Kardashian. So, yeah. And she's some kind of Jew, right?
Well, was charged with Armenian. A lot of people think Armenians are Jews. What Armenians are is Khazars. The Jews are a Khazar people, and so are the Armenians, hence the physical resemblance. I think that's a high yellow nigger. Without the makeup, yeah, I think that's a high yellow nigger. McDonald's hamburgers lure a naked man off tower. Oh, Los Angeles. Los Angeles again. Okay. The same city, and there's a picture of him, and the same city where you can't throw footballs or frisbees on the beach or dig holes, but you can be naked on a tower and lured down by McDonald's. Okay. Police were able to lure a naked man who spent hours atop a downtown radio tower with McDonald's hamburgers. Okay. It was unclear why he climbed the structure, which is part of a city. Oh, why does anybody take off their clothes and climb a radio tower downtown? Okay. He removed items of clothing after he... Oh, he was doing a striptease as he went up the tower. He started taking off his clothes as he climbed. Okay. Doesn't say much about how they lured him down with... At one point, he asked for hamburgers from McDonald's. Officials complied, and he agreed to come down after eating his meal. Okay.
Wait, so they threw it up there, too?
I guess they must have taken it up there, and he had a naked Happy Meal up on top of the tower, and then he came down. I can't think of a racial angle for this, except to show how utterly, completely insane our society has become. Okay, Marines posed with Nazi SS symbol in Afghanistan. You know, you would think that by now, or after Abu Ghraib especially, these dumb servicemen would realize not to take stupid pictures like that with their video cams and send them home to their... Okay. That's pretty blatant. I don't know what the... Well, they all seem to be white, too. I gotta admit, that's kind of a cool photo. There's a bunch of gyrenes sitting there with their weapons and their web gear and everything, big American flag, and then an SS flag below. Number one, how did that SS flag get there? Who got it? Who ordered it? And for what purpose? Number two, again, I have to ask, how can these guys not understand what might happen if they take pictures like this? This kind of worries me about white Americans. We just don't seem to learn. Okay, if you're going to torture prisoners in Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq and teach them the joys of gay bondage and all that sort of stuff, why are you going to take pictures of it with your video cam and email it to your girlfriend back in West Virginia?
Oh, there was something dumb.
What? Okay.
School considers ban on cross-dressing.
Cross-dressing, okay. Virginia School District considers cross-dressing ban for students. You know, as bad as my high school was back in the day, I don't think any of us, even the worst, most screwed-up, hippy-dippy, drug-addled, brain-fried loser, would have even considered coming to school in women's clothes.
I went to high school with a lot of people who did. In Eugene, Oregon, boys in sometimes they wore like these long black velvet dresses and all kinds of vampire makeup, and sometimes they wore kind of like hippie patchwork skirts and had long dreads.
Okay. All right. A Virginia school is considering banning cross-dressing by students out of what one board member called concerns for the safety of several male students who wear dresses and wigs to school. Okay, where in Virginia is this? Are they still in some place where they might actually have a few good old boys in there who might take offense? In Suffolk County, I'm not sure where that is. I can imagine what they're after, though. Some of the jocks or some of the country kids might say, "Why are you wearing a dress, boy? You some kind of faggot?"
Probably.
"You a sissy boy?" I really thought my high school was bad at the time with the niggers and the racial violence and the drugs and the general liberal stupidity, but I swear, I would not want to be a teenager right now. I would not want to have to go through a modern high school because I can tell it would just be 10 times worse. Okay. The proposal explicitly bans clothing not in keeping with a student's gender. Okay, does that apply to girls wearing pantsuits as well? Distracts others from the educational process or poses health concerns. Board members will not vote on the proposal, which would take effect next year if approved. Okay, well, how are they going to approve it if they're not going to vote on it? So there's plenty of time for discussion, district spokeswoman Beth Ann Bradshaw. Blah, 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 blah. The moral to this story, I think, is make sure you homeschool your kids all the way through high school. Cited reports about male students who wore feminine clothing last year and had to use faculty restrooms due to safety concerns. Okay, in other words, if they tried to go in the wrong restroom, they'd get the crap beaten out of them. They tried to go into the boys' room dressed like women, they'd probably get the crap beaten out of them by the boys. And if they tried to go in the girls' room being male, they'd probably get the crap beaten out of them by the girls. Well, in a way, I suppose this is good. It means that there may be some kids left in high school who are still man enough to stand up to this degeneracy.
Teacher to be fired for calling student Jew boy.
Oh, okay. Let's go check that one out.
I actually heard a story recently about some teacher picking on niggers or whatever, but let's check this one out.
Now, would that be the Los Angeles school teacher that was tying them up and forcing them to eat, his bodily secretions?
He told them, like, big, fat, black, and
stuff. Oh, yeah, that was in Minnesota. We found that guy's address, and I sent him a white book.
Oh, nice.
And it was, like, the wrong address.
Well, there are two individuals by that name. Probably shouldn't say the name on the air, but there are two individuals by that name. I sent it to one address. The guy that came up with that name was pretty sure it was the guy, and so I sent it to that address. I might have sent him to him. In which case, there's a guy who's going to get a white book somewhere in Minneapolis and not know where the hell it came from.
He might still become one of us.
Yeah, right. Yeah. During the 19th and early 20th century, this country was populated largely by mass white immigration from Europe, the whole Ellis Island deal. Although, of course, certain immigrant groups, like the Jews, weren't white, and certain others, like Russian anarchists and Sicilian mafiosi, weren't exactly desirable. For most of these immigrants, the Poles and Italians and Germans and the Scandinavians and the poor English weavers and the Welsh miners, they couldn't see the back of their own countries fast enough, and very few, if any, ever actually went back. For the Irish, it was different. From the flight of the Earls in 1608, for Ireland, immigration has always been a curse, a people forced into leaving their own land because of famine, or political or religious persecution, or the most terrible poverty in Europe. Poverty that made even Poland and southern Italy look prosperous and well-fed by comparison. For the Irish, immigration was always a tragedy and a nightmare, and much of their music reflects that. Some years ago, an American named Peter Jones was rummaging around in his attic and he found a series of letters that had been written to his immigrant great-grandfather by the man's own father, who lived in a village in County Mayo called Kilkelly. Peter Jones happened to be a songwriter, and so he wrote this song, but not really, because the lyrics are simply quotes from his ancestor's letter. Multiply the pain that you hear in the words of this old man long gone by about 20 million times, and you'll start to understand why the Irish are the way they are.
Kilkelly, Ireland, 1860, my dear and loving son John. Your good friend, the schoolmaster, Pat McNamara, so good as to write these words down. Your brothers have all gone to find work in England. The house is so empty and sad. The crop of potatoes is sorely infected. A third to a half of them bad. And your sister Bridget and Patrick O'Donnell are going to be married in June. Your mother says not to work on the railroad and be sure to come on home soon. Kilkelly, Ireland, 1870, my dear and loving son John. Hello to your missus and to your four children. May they grow healthy and strong. Michael has got in a wee bit of trouble, I suppose, that he never will learn. Because of the dampness, there's no turf to speak of, and now we have nothing to burn. Bridget is happy you named a child for her, although she's got six of her own. You say you found work, but you don't say what kind or when you'll be coming home. Kilkelly, Ireland, 1880, dear Michael and John, my sons. I'm sorry to give you the very sad news that your dear old mother has gone. We buried her down at the church in Kilkelly. Your brothers and Bridget were there. She died very quickly. Remember her in your prayers. And it's so good to hear that Michael's returning with money he's sure to buy land. For the crop has been poor and the people are selling at any price that they can. Thank you. 18 and 90, my dear and loving son John. I suppose that I must be close on 80. It's 30 years since you've gone. Because of all of the money you sent me, I'm still living out my home. Michael has built himself a fine house, and Bridget's daughters are grown. And thank you for sending your family picture. They're lovely young women and men. You say that you might even come for a visit. What joy to see you again. Kilkelly, Ireland, 18 and 92, my dear brother John. I'm sorry I didn't write sooner to tell you that father passed on. He was living with Bridget, she says he was cheerful and healthy right down to the end. Ah, you should have seen him playing with the grandchildren. Buried him alongside of mother down at Kilkelly churchyard. He was a strong and a feisty old man, considering his life so hard. And it's funny the way he kept talking about you. He called for you at the end. Think about coming to visit. We'd all love to see you again.
As I predicted at the beginning of the show, we're running way long this week, so I'll have to wind this up. I don't have much time, but it does look like I need to give you folks a quick reminder of something that I mentioned a few weeks ago. And that is that as part of your initial contact with the Northwest Front, you will be expected to give us your mailing address for your white book and your first introductory packet of party literature, and also your real name, so we can at least run a cursory background check on you. No other white nationalist group does that, but we do. I know it's not perfect, and we probably couldn't spot a real deep cover informer, but we can at least go through the motions, for Christ's sake. Now, what is not going to happen is that I am not going to engage in a long, deep, intimate, spiritual, and philosophical discourse with some complete stranger, knowing nothing about him or her except an email address. I still don't get why anyone would think that I would do something like that. But apparently there are a lot of people out there who do. We had another one this week. It's simple, guys. If I talk to you, I intend to know who the hell I'm talking to. What's so unreasonable about that? Anyway, that's the name of that tune. But our time is up now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. And all of our Irish listeners, I hope you have a great Lollifothrick and survive whatever Guinness-sodden escapades you get up to. Until then, Sasha an de bon. Freedom.